WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org. If you missed any of Out FM, it'll be on the website in about 5 or 10 minutes. Coming up next is Ecologic with yours truly, Ken Gale. You just heard the announcement about, and you can hear everything. It's live streamed on WBAI.org, so call your friends anywhere in the world. They can hear it.
Oh, people, people, don't you love this earth? Share with everything that grows. Don't you want to taste freedom, peace in this life? I believe we can make it whole again. I believe we can make it whole.
They paid paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on following.
See a windmill go, feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Hi, I'm Ken Gale, and this is Ecologic for July 9th, 2013, here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org, where every day is Earth Day. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the federal agency the Weather Service is part of, is predicting above-average storm activity again this summer. All independent analysis I have read agrees with that. That means more named storms, more hurricanes, and more severe hurricanes. This is consistent with climate change and melted Arctic ice cap conditions. It's more climate chaos. This May was the third hottest May since 1880. For more info, go to www.noaa.gov. NOAA.gov. But in this related story, the New York ISO is predicting an excess capacity over peak electricity usage of nearly 5,000 megawatts. That includes the loss of over 500 megawatts due to a Newburgh power plant being damaged beyond economic repair by Sandy. Meanwhile, Con Ed is requesting a 3.3% rate increase. President Obama's climate action plan released 2 weeks ago calls for more methane, what they market as natural gas, and more nuclear power, two contributors to climate chaos, especially the methane. The methane they get from fracking also contains radioactive radon, so those two energy sources are both cancer sources. And I'd be remiss in not pointing out that the oil train wreck that killed a number of people in Quebec could just as easily happen in a high-pressure pipeline in New Jersey, the West Village, or on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn. That's why those pipelines have to be stopped. SaneEnergyProject.org is a great place to find out how to stop those pipelines. SaneEnergyProject.org. The latest Center for Biological Diversity newsletter is available at www.biologicaldiversity.org. along with articles on endangered species and endangered ecosystems, is an article on genetically modified crops already used in the food we're eating now. That's www.biologicaldiversity.org. And I finally got to the whales exhibit at the Natural History Museum, and I'm angry that there was almost no conservation or whaling included in the exhibit. The implication is that whaling ended a while ago, and so did conservation efforts. If you didn't know better, you might not realize these magnificent beings are still being killed and some species are in danger of extinction. There's more information about whales on YouTube and cable TV, and I have very little respect for cable TV, and definitely more about whaling conservation and how to protect them. I guess they didn't want to anger the governments of Japan, Norway, and Iceland. New York Food and Water Watch is having a bus trip to see Pennsylvania fracking sites on Saturday, July 27th, leaving from 34th and 8th. For more info, go to their website, though it won't be easy to find the information. foodandwaterwatch.org. If you signed up for a kayak lesson during the last fund drive, no one in the premiums department told me about it. Luckily, one person who did pledge for the lessons is a friend with another producer who emailed me. Donna Stein of New York City Friends of Clearwater is still willing to give you a kayak lesson in exchange for a donation to WBAI of $100. It's a two-hour kayak lesson with Donna on the Hudson River near Midtown Manhattan on a Saturday or Sunday morning this summer. You'll learn and practice how to control the boat, forward stroke, moving the kayak sideways, and more. You and Donna will work out which day is convenient to both of you. Go to give2wbai.org. It's www.give2wbai.org and put kayak, K-A-Y-A-K, in the search box. Or call 516-620-3602. Tell them you want a kayak lesson. 516-620-3602. If Ecologic is on 2 weeks from now, the subject will be economics and will be co-hosted by Peter Rue. I say if because there are persistent rumors of several scenarios with that result. All I can tell you for sure is that all paid staff, including operations staff, news reporters, and drive time folks, were told they may be laid off July 15th because there is not enough money to pay them, which is why there are rumors that the station will broadcast another Pacifica station for a while. Probably many people will be laid off and a few kept. If Ecologic is off the air and I'm laid off, I will try to have a new episode of Ecologic put onto the Ecologic website every Tuesday evening, either a recording I never aired or something from a past show. On my website are direct links to hear past shows on the WBAI archives page. That's www.comicbookradioshow.com/eco-logic.html. You can hear a show on ecoterrorism and homeland security. That was from 2 weeks ago, and one on fracking. Normally, shows are archived for 90 days, but there have been problems with the archiving software. Hopefully, that's been resolved. That's www.comicbookradioshow.com/eco-logic.html. And if you've been listening to the carts about me doing a comic book segment on Hour of the Wolf tomorrow night, you'll know why I have that website. I did that show before I did Ecologic. When your air or water is clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said. This is Ken Gale for Ecologic, WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And Martha Eddy has not arrived yet. She's on her way. And Jennifer Monson couldn't make it at all. So right now, it's just me and Lisa. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And it's Lise.
Lise, yes. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Everyone makes a mistake.
And move the mic a little closer.
Okay. Aha, okay.
And as I was telling people, I'm doing a dance episode of Ecologic. People are like giving me quizzical looks. Like they couldn't imagine how dance could be used to educate and activate. And after talking to you and Martha those last few days, I'm thinking, you know, cultures throughout the world use dance to educate on all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it shouldn't be a surprise, but I guess that's how we're brought up. Dance is like a recreational activity only.
Well, I think, you know, in this country, we have a weird view about all kinds of art, mm-hmm. that somehow it's separate from real life, that it doesn't really have anything to do with anything except itself. And, I mean, I certainly was brought up in that tradition as a dancer. You know, dancing happened. I started off as a ballet dancer, and, you know, ballet classes happened over there, and then, you know, you go to the opera house. So it was for most people, quite separated. But for me, the thing about being a dancer and becoming a choreographer was all about how I felt about the world. You know, it's about how I lived in the world. And so for me, it's always been a question of how am I going to communicate, like, what I'm seeing. And so it thinking about dance as part of a way to communicate what I'm thinking and seeing about mostly the urban environment, because that's mostly what I'm really interested in. Although I'm also a fracking activist, so there's mm-hmm. that. But I've been really, really interested in the whole question of what do people actually see when they walk down the street? You know, kind of anywhere, because I've done a lot of traveling and I've lived in a lot of different places. So it's become that has become something that's just really fascinating to me.
Well, the cliche is when people walk down the street, they just look down and they're not looking at anything.
And that's often true.
And but as a choreographer, you're looking at a whole lot more.
Well,
as all artists do, filmmakers, graphic artists, whoever.
Right. I mean, and of course, you have to remember to do it, right? Because we all get so caught in our own, uh-huh. like, thing. And that's actually what my projects have been aimed at in the last few years, is breaking both me, first me, because until I know what it is I'm trying to get someone else to do, obviously I can't uh-huh. create a structure, right? Or when I used to choreograph a dance, you know, you have to, I always felt that I had to know what it was I was going for before I could ask someone else to try and do it.
So, but you don't make it up as you go along. You have the whole thing in your head already.
I do a lot of preparation. I remember, and, you know, I mean, that partly comes out of spending, I mean, I don't much anymore, but I made my living for a long time teaching ballet. You know, I very much come from that tradition of you show up every day at 10 o'clock and you do your plies. But I also have, you know, I have an almost equally long tradition in the sort of postmodern and improvisational world, even though I never talk about myself or think of myself as an improviser. But you know, it's just a question of what is it that you're practicing, right? And I think, and for me, that's really the key thing. It's like, it feels to me as though so much of what we're practicing right now in this country, in this city, pretty much on any level, is not seeing the truth, you know, is not mm-hmm. looking at what's really happening. And I feel like the thing that has kept me engaged with making art, you know, which sounds kind of whatever, but is really that it's my excuse for living a life that's constantly trying to look freshly at things. I had a writing teacher who said, you know, you have to be really stupid about the color yellow. You have to be really stupid about that cat. You have to be so, like, what is it? You know, and I feel like that's actually profoundly important.
Being stupid isn't profoundly important.
Being stupid, yeah. Being willing to say, what actually am I looking at here? You know, I mean, I live in Williamsburg, and this is a big question. That's the urban environment, right? You know, it's like, which is engaged with concrete and buildings and all kinds of things, along with trees and dogs and cats and people and rats and birds and everything else. So, but, you know, it's amazing how quickly you stop seeing all the new high rises, even though it's a profoundly different neighborhood ecosystem than it was 6 years ago.
Right.
And all the implications that has about the money, about the, you know, who's on the street, who's allowed to be on the, well, allowed, who, you know, who's comfortable on the street, you know,
the amount of sunlight.
The amount of sunlight, the number of backyards, you know, all these kinds of things. And I'm not trying to say that one is better than another. What I'm saying is there are differences. And it's so easy to stop seeing those differences. We are so able to stop looking.
Well, in climate change, people stop seeing that the climate is changing because it has changed.
Exactly.
And so it's now the way the climate is.
Yeah.
And people forget about the way the climate was.
Yeah.
Even if they're paying through the nose for air conditioning or whatever.
I mean, this is one of the things I really noticed, right? Because I moved to Brooklyn, to Carroll Gardens in the early 80s because it was cheap. And at that time, in the summer, everyone was on the street. At that point, it was still mostly Italian, mostly people who, you know, would have been working on the docks if there were still docks. So, you know, it was a whole union thing. So the streets were full of kids and people sitting on the stoop. Now you walk down a city, when I walk around Williamsburg in the summer, there's no one on the street. Everyone's inside. And, you know, it's just, that's a profoundly different experience of, you know, the urban choreography, if you want to call it that.
Now, when you decide to do a dance having to do with environmental issues, what goes through your mind? Do you think of the issue first, or do you think of a style? What do you think of?
Well, so the first thing to understand about what I do is that I don't any longer make dances with dancers. I mean, I do if somebody wants me to, which is great. It's always really fun. But I love making dances on stages. What I'm doing in site-specific work, especially at least these days, is I'm looking at the urban choreography, right? I'm looking at a section of a neighborhood. I'm looking at a street. I'm looking at, or an issue. One of the things I did was a collaboration with Uli Lorimer, who is the wonderful, fabulous, and fantastic curator of the Native Plant Garden at the Brooklyn Botanical Garden. And what we were doing was going around the city looking for native plants. Now, what that came out of for me was I had this romantic notion that there might be native plants just growing alongside, say, McGinnis Boulevard or the Long Island Railroad tracks, or who knew? You know, I thought, who knows what's there? Let's go find them. And I thought, wouldn't that be amazing if that was true? There was just a poetry about that I loved. So I met Uli through Jennifer Monson's Island. Every summer there are people who are residents and who do, and it's a scientist and a movement person, and you do a collaborative project together, which involves a public presentation.
That's the interdisciplinary part of
it. That's and so Uli and I did that in 2007, the second year that Jennifer, you know, offered that opportunity. And at that point, I had moved back from Europe about a year earlier. I'd been gone for about 5 years. I was shocked at what had happened in the city. You know, I lived here till 2000, and I did that thing you do. I didn't notice what was happening over the, you know, 25 years or 20 years that I was living in the city. And then I was gone for 5 or 6 years, and I came back, and all of a sudden, it felt to me, we had Bloomberg's New York. You know, and I was like, well, now what the hell is this? City I left. Where is the city I left? So I did several projects that were sort of in that.
What kind of projects?
Well, these are all projects that are about organizing how audience participants, it's really more about participant than audience, because it's not like they're sitting there watching somebody else. This is about people taking a walk. You could call it a guided walking tour, you know, but there are very, I use maps. I've used sound art. I've used a whole bunch of, what I've tried to do is to use what you use in a piece of choreography that's on stage as, in the same way that you use it for dancers. It's a cue, it's a trigger. So the project with Uli, I was interested in where are the native plants, and, you know, where is this one piece of the original New York ecosystem environment? You know, where can we find that? And he very quickly disabused me of the notion that they were just lying around anywhere. And we ended up in Red Hook and Coney Island and Floyd Bennett Field. because it's really the, you know, those sort of, well, beaches that still have native plants. And so what he and I did was a lot of walking, a lot of looking, a lot of me observing how he was in this quest for native plants, what he did, specifically the things he did, how he walked, where he went. And as I think I said to you earlier, one of the things that I kept noticing was that he never stuck to the rules that the sidewalks and the boundaries, property boundaries and mm-hmm. so on imposed, because that was completely irrelevant to him, as it would be to any plant. And I found that fascinating. And so what we ended up setting up, one of the things we did was to figure out how we could get people who would go along with us on this public outing to also break those rules and to feel comfortable about breaking those rules and to maybe do it without even knowing they're doing it until later.
So you're choreographing a bunch of non-dancers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not about dancers. It's about people who are interested in looking at the city in a way they might not have otherwise. And that's really what I mean. I'm interested in getting people to pay attention so that, because my feeling is if we get more clear about what used to be and what is now mm-hmm. and that juxtaposition, then there's a possibility for doing that other thing that artists do, which is reimagining the world in the image that they wish to see it.
Right. And now, I remember you mentioned you had a background in hiking.
Oh, yeah. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest.
And it looks like Martha might be here.
Yay.
So you've had an interest in well, did you develop your interest in hiking and dance sort of at the same time?
No, hiking was my dad's thing.
Your dad's thing. Okay.
But walking is, you know, walking is something I've done all my life, and it's the basis of all movement, human movement. Mm-hmm. I mean, not all, but it's the basis of how we locomote.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, choreographers wander around studios all the time, so it's a very and everybody knows how to do it. So it's a way to engage a whole group of people without things being really difficult and complicated.
And hello. Martha Eddy has arrived.
Hello.
And you're listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. And Martha, we were just talking about, I guess, sort of everyday life looked upon the way a choreographer would, which is not like the way that everybody else does.
So how we view the world? That's a big question.
Certainly, you and I have talked before about the fact that most dancers are trained to really watch movement in a very particular way and to see the details of body language as well as just diversity and variation. So both looking at meaning, what it means that people position themselves in certain ways, but also what you can do with it aesthetically and expressively.
Yeah, well, and I was talking about just now most of my projects recently have not been with dancers. They've been about, in a way, just providing a map for anybody who wants to follow, you know, with either, well, I did one project that used payphones in the East Village and sound art on those payphones. You know, it was a whole collaboration with a computer guy. Mm-hmm. But the idea, it was called Peter Stuyvesant's Ghost. And the whole idea was to get people walking around the East Village looking for payphones, which is my history because I moved here in 81, and then listening to these sound files about the Dutch that was somehow related to Peter Stuyvesant. So really, you know, that European switch from the Native American landscape to what we've got now. Mm. And so for me, what's one of the things that's really fascinating about that is, you know, when you make a dance, you put it in a space. Right. So I've been really curious about just expanding choreography and movement into this maybe more theoretical thing, but I don't feel like it's theoretical at all. It's like, you know, people are making pathways through space in a deliberate way, and that is really what dancers do.
Well, what's interesting to me about what you're saying is that it's also not just in space, it's in time.
Yeah.
You're looking at historical and contemporary overlays, which is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I also think is the amazingly wonderful and unusual thing about dance is that, you know, you're constantly dealing with that, that everything's shifting all the time, that it's never a static, it's not a statue, you know.
I've heard filmmakers and comic book writers and artists refer to places as characters. You know, a filmmaker will say that they set a movie in New York City because New York City was a character they wanted to convey in, or whatever story, and you're both nodding your head. So clearly dancing uses location as a character also.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, dances change. I mean, a choreographed dance changes completely from stage to stage or situation to situation.
Absolutely. And the whole notion of site-specific performance is so much about allowing the space to establish various components. It could be the source for the choreographic content. It could be the response, the way that the dance gets adapted because of the space, or it could be the particular audience that it draws. And in many of the works that I work with, that means that the audience may be participating in a different way. Either as very active audience members or passive audience members or performers or spontaneous participants. So location makes a big difference.
Yeah, and I actually, in when I started developing sort of the ideas that ended up becoming things like the Peter Stuyvesant's Ghost Project or the project I did with Uli, I was influenced a lot. I started thinking about this when I was living in Europe and in a lot of different locations, and I was influenced a lot by architects I met there who were talking about how, who were talking about the sort of inherent drama in buildings, like what they saw as inherent drama. And there was one lighting designer in particular, Herbert Cebulska, who just, you know, he would just light pieces of walls and things like that. And I thought, well, now that's fascinating. So how does the space itself perform? And, of course, in a city like New York, things are being performed all the time. You know, there's so much going on. The question is, how do you focus people's attention on what it is? How do I focus people's attention on what it is I'm interested in them seeing?
Perceiving and seeing, okay. Yeah.
Which is also, I mean, since you're focusing so much on water, you know, that would also be what you must be doing,
too. Absolutely. It's interesting. What you drew my attention to first, though, is the Global Water Dances Project. It was established by a group of Laban movement analysts. And part of our...
What movement analysts?
Laban. So it's a particular person, Rudolf Laban, who lived in Berlin and was very much part of the Bauhaus. So, again, part of a consortium of thinkers that were looking at time and space in a very specific way, working with architects. He himself did design theaters for dance, including theaters in the round. So one of the assignments we have when people are training as movement analysts is to pick a space that they like and to simply move in it and to see what the space evokes. As movement analysts, we're trained to understand the spatial components of the human body and movement and be able to name them. So part of what we're doing after we've moved in the space is then to reflect and describe not just sort of the sensations or the emotional experience, but literally how we shaped our bodies in that space and how the space impacted the process.
That's, it's, well, there's a lot in what you just said. For one thing, I spent many years studying with and teaching for Alfredo Corvino. And Alfredo has a direct link with Laban because, you know, he danced with Jos. So there's a whole history, there's a whole sort of lineage of Laban, Mary Wigman, Kurt Jos.
Kurt Jos choreographed The Green Table. He's most famous for that, which was a big kind of political commentary on kind of post-World War II.
Right. And that's the whole lineage that Pina Bausch came out of. And if you're thinking about a theatricalized space or thinking about choreography as encompassing everything that goes on within any given theatrical event, she's one of the great ones. I mean, she was really one of the people who, you know, everything mattered. You know,
say her name again.
Pina Bausch. She's very famous.
Better spell it because people are going to want to look her up.
B-A-U-S-C-H, right? Mm-hmm. And she died a few years ago, but she's amazing. And so.
And there's a feature film on her now.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, studying ballet with Alfredo, because the Jost tradition had all of this Laban inside of it, but they used a ballet bar as the way to train the dancers. And you got to understand this was considered highly contemporary dance, right? Very, very modern. And it's still used as the basis for a lot of the training in at the Folkfang in Germany. So anyway, it's what was so interesting about working all those years with Alfredo was that for him, every single one of the formalized, you know, positions, and there are many in ballet, it's definitely a lexicon, it was always about your relationship to the space around you. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was this constant discussion of how, you know, what you had to shift within that particular form to make it work with where you were in the room, where you were in relationship to other people. And of course, this is totally common training, but he did it at such a high level.
So how do you translate that to educating about environmental issues, activating on environmental issues?
I'd love to segue to that because it was this very same thinking that allowed Rudolf Laban in the teens, 20s, and 30s to develop what are called movement choirs. So movement choirs are these choral works that could involve 40 dancers, or he got them to be as large as 10,000, often done on Labor Day. So part of the Labor Day celebration was to take even work movement and with rehearsals, with music scored, practiced in multiple places. People would come together for the parade and perform these large dances. Now, there are different ways to envision that, but I'd like people to think of kind of the common thing that might happen, let's say, in a stadium where people do the wave out of excitement, you know, just like where one thing moves to another, one person's hand ripples through someone else's chest, through someone else's hand, or the wave where the arms are above the head.
Right, everybody and moves waving. Their arm at the same time in a row, and it goes down the cross.
Exactly.
The
so it's either all at the same time or a ripple effect. So those are two of the most simple structures of a movement choir. And our whole idea with developing the Global Water Dances Project was to include movement choirs, to make these site-specific performances where small or large groups would get together and use the movement choir format to convey either appreciation of water or a sense of the challenges we as humanity are dealing with water on our planet.
Huh, that's interesting.
Give an example.
Okay, so the structure of the Global Water Dances, which is this biennial event that happens on a single day in multiple locations around the world. So, for instance, in 2011, there were 54 sites involved. And in 2013, a similar number, but in some different sites. We have a common piece of choreography that each site works with and is pretty much replicated, although, again, because of the spatial constraints, is adapted to the site and also based on how many people are there as performers. So an example there would be evoking a picture of a river. So not that different from the wave that I was describing in the stadium. Right. We would start leaning with everybody gradated with their head leaning and their arms leaning to the right. And then when you got to the end of the line, from that far right, the person there would begin to lean to the left, and then slowly down through 40 people, everybody would be leaning to the left. So just a sense of a river flowing. It's a simple one.
Big smile from Lise here.
It's such a beautiful, it's so simple, and it's so, you know, and it's so potent at the same time. You know, I think for me, so when I listen
Hi,
to you talk about
Hi, I'm Ken Gale, WBAI's Tuesday evening environmental show, Ecologic.
What the heck was that?
It's an echo, echo. Yeah. Another dance structure we use a lot of,
yes,
the canon, the echo.
Repetition. But I was going to say that, you know, it seems to me that obviously you're organizing all of this out of a great sense of maybe urgency, but also love.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think for me that's always been the underlying reason for doing any of the dance making that I've done is, you know, being in love with discovering movement, being in love with first arabesque for a while, you know. But, you know, a big part of my motivation for doing the pieces I've done, the site-specific pieces, has been a question about what is home. How do we know what is home? And let's just bring it down to me, what is it that I can do to help in some small way keep my home the home I want it to be?
Mm.
You know, and I think that's, for me anyway, that's profoundly wise, like that's why I'm a fracking activist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so for me, it's a very direct connection. You know, my artwork and environmental concerns those are the things I love.
Is choreography like directing a movie? Is it like coaching an athletic team? How would you describe choreography to someone who, you know, looks at dance but doesn't think about how it's done?
I'll tie into
they're looking at each other like, you take that first.
Yeah. Well, it's a leap. You took us on a leap. So I'm going to try to tie it together, which is this idea that we dance because we love something, whether it's the dance itself or something we're trying to communicate about. The way we choreograph is as diverse as the number of people doing choreography. Mm-hmm. There are some traditions in choreography. I think it's actually one of the least developed of our scholarship, just the lexicon, the language of choreography.
Yeah,
but some people, for instance, start with the whole group improvising with an idea, the whole group meaning the dance company that they're paying, and other people come in with something highly stylized and completed and then just teach it. And then there's sort of every combination thereupon, where they start with a phrase and everybody makes it their own. I think of a lot of different choreographers who are doing that more and more, where they want each dancer to have more of their own personality for the character mm-hmm. of the person to actually show through, versus a corps de ballet where you're basically more like a movement choir and all contributing to a concept and sort of being a kind of, in a good way, a wash, a gouache.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of different approaches to choreography. In the case of Global Water Dances, we hoped that everybody involved would be concerned and in love and in appreciation of water. And because of that, even though we scored, and that's a way to talk about choreography being rather loose with some open decisions, we create a score versus a very set choreographed dance.
Or you could also call the score just the structure.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like
so.
The scaffolding versus the wall and the facades.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Our score was pretty tight, and we actually had some ideas, but we were willing to let people adjust it. And as a matter of fact, it was important to us that each group adjust it according to two things, the site itself and the issues that permeate that site or that culture or that city.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I mentioned earlier when you and I were speaking, Ken, that, for instance, in Mexico City in 2011, that group chose to dance in a dry riverbed, which is a completely different experience than what happened in Prague in 2013, where they actually couldn't use their site because it was so flooded.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of adjustments are critical. Just, I have to dance differently in these two media. And then secondly, the feeling about having no water or having too much water is going to inform the content of the dance as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should mention a dance I saw that really got this show started in my mind. And I have no idea what troupe did it, what group did it, who the choreographer was, but it was at one of the many eco fairs that the city has. It was along the Hudson River, and people were dressed up as sea creatures, and then other people were dressed up as pollution that were sort of endangering the sea creatures, and then other people were coming in as recyclers who would make the garbage into recycling. And then you had another people dressed up as for solar power and wind power, which is going to save everybody and make everybody happy. And I'm watching this, and in 15 minutes, she conveyed a lot of, or I should say they conveyed a lot of ideas on environmental issues in a short space. And you know, I've written comic books, which you have to think visually for that. Mm-hmm. And this was another visual medium that I hadn't ever thought much about until that moment. And I realized that someday this is going to make a really good episode of Ecologic. I just want to find a number of people because, for example, Martha and Lisa are going to have things to say to each other that I wouldn't even think of because you're both choreographers and dancers. And so I'm sort of the person we were talking about how important it is to be stupid. Earlier in the show. So I'm the one who's got to be stupid for everybody who doesn't know, and you guys could go into detail on dance.
Well, just to kind of follow on, I mean, as Martha said, there's a different way to choreograph for every choreographer that exists, and there are different ideas about what would tell the story for every choreographer as well. And, you know, Jennifer Monson isn't here, but the project that started off her whole Island Institute, I think, I'm pretty sure this is true, was a project she did that was not part of Island. It was her birds project. And basically, I mean, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that went into the birds project, but, or maybe it was called Flight. I'm terrible with names. Anyway, she traveled all over the place. I know all over the country. It may have been also some international travel, looking at migratory patterns of birds. And, I mean, literally, like bird watching, you know, and standing in fields. And you know, she's an improviser, making dances in those fields and with other improvisers and really trying to get a sense into her body and into their bodies of what those birds might be feeling, you know, because that's one thing you do as a dancer. You try to figure out how to embody the thing it is that you're interested in, and you know whether you're being a swan in Swan Lake or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. So that it's quite literal in a certain sense. But you know what was so interesting about that project, when I think about what I know about her trajectory after that, is that you know she started Island, which was all about sort of taking this idea and allowing other people to experiment with it. But then she ended up working at the University of Illinois, where she's been doing these amazing projects with water scientists and, you know, all kinds of things. And so, you know, the dances she's making are some of them quite abstract and some of them quite literal. But, you know, they're about making these connections to so many different things that are going on in the physical world and about pollution or not and all this kind of stuff. And that to me is what I have found. That's my real motivation. It's like, how can I use this art form that I spent so much of my life inside a studio with? Mm-hmm. You know, how can I take this thing which is so much about communication and really use it in that way? You know, and, to me, that's a very, very interesting ongoing question.
Well, yeah, it sounds like a lifelong ongoing question.
Yeah.
There are two responses I'm having to what you're saying. One is to link back to comics or to visual forms like film, and to say that one of the reasons I love dance as a participatory art form is that it requires this embodiment that Lisa's talking about. And so I love the conceptual. I love watching movies. I love relaxing back. And there's a place in me as both an educator and a dance movement. I'm actually a somatic movement therapist, where I feel like part of the health of our planet is dependent on human beings being more aware of their bodies.
Yeah.
And the link between our own physical health being impacted by the health of the planet. So the more that people begin to be more sensate and literally sensate about their own soma, their living body, their somatic self, the more there's a likelihood of having an inkling of caring. If I care about my body, I might care about the resources I need. I really loved during Ed Henkel's movement talks at the 92nd Street Y last year in 2012. I had the luxury of speaking and helping him put together a panel. And I know others of us have had great forums with Ed. Highly recommend it.
Everyone should go.
It's at the Y, 92 yeah. Y. Basically, one of the people I brought to the panel was Charles McKinney, who's the urban designer for the New York City Parks Department. And he was learning about our project in the process of the panel.
Right.
And by the end of the panel, he was able to just create a synopsis of the importance of dance. I think he pointed out four things. One was the pleasure in it. The second was the fitness element. The third was the perhaps environmental awareness. But one that really struck me most was he talked about it as a resource for empathy.
Oh, completely.
And he was so excited about that empathy because he thought, if you go into that park and dance in it and then start to care about the park, that's all I could care for. I want less people littering and more people caring about this park. So it was just fantastic.
You know, that reminds me, you were asking me about hiking earlier. And, you know, I was brought up in the Pacific Northwest and did a lot of hiking as a kid. And gardening. And, you know, my father comes from the plains of eastern Colorado, and, you know, my grandparents were pioneers. So there's a lot of, I was brought up in a family and with a point of view about the world that was very much about you don't litter because you're hurting the land. You know, and also I'm of the age where, you know, does anybody else remember the ad of the Indian chief standing on the burning Erie Canal? Or I can't even remember what it was, but anyway. So, but for me, you know, one of the things that people have said to me about my projects is I never realized, for instance, that that empty lot in Coney Island was teeming with such interesting life and what kinds of history you could find out just by looking at what plants are growing there.
Right.
So that empathy thing, it's huge.
And it's also, she's raising the point that as site-specific performers, we're also archaeologists.
Yes.
So we're anthropologists looking at human movement, but we're also archaeologists. Like, what's the history in the space?
Yeah.
It's also, the first thing I thought of was Pete Seeger building the Clearwater, having the Clearwater
built
to put people on the water
so
they would have a feeling about the water and want to protect it.
Yeah.
Which clearly worked because the Hudson River is way cleaner than it was when the Clearwater was first built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Well, look at what happens when people start with all the community gardens, right? I mean, you know, I'm in one up on Skillman, and, you know, we've got kids who come in, well, there's projects right next door, and there are so many people around in that neighborhood who never do anything tactile, you know, with a growing thing. And we get these kids who come in and, you know, these people, and they're like, wow, smell the mint. You know, it's like, it's a revelation, you know? And I just think this is so important. And it's one of the things that dancing gives every dancer, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have to stand on that studio floor and use your body.
And I grew up in East Harlem, and my parents settled there in like 1949 and 50. My dad tells a story of driving in their carryall and just pointing to this tree that was coming into foliage, just its leaves were coming out. And the child next to him that was in the car, happened to be in the car with him, said, "Norm, I know where there's another tree." That was it for East Harlem in the 40s, late 40s.
Wow.
So one of the things my family did was with a consortium of other groups, get a farm in Putnam County and create a family camp so whole families could go up and have the experience you're talking about. Now, I'm so glad we're so strong. And one of the projects we're doing with water that I do on the interim years between the biennial Global Water Dances is called the Ins and Outs of Water, where we go into community gardens and have educational workshops that are participatory, that include doing some movement choir about water, but also can have puppet shows about pollution or sing-alongs with people like Ray Corona, and also have little lectures on the importance, experiential lectures actually, on the importance of water for the human body and health. So that's just something that I'm hoping we'll get more funding for, to be able to bring these varying artists, including musicians, puppeteers, dancers, everybody, that kind of get people active, whether it's with singing, hand action, whole body action, drawing. We've done splatter painting and let it get rained on and see what happens.
Gives you to a thought, but first, you're listening to Ecologic on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. We're talking about the intersection of the environment and dance, and my two guests are...
Lise Brenner.
From?
Originally?
No, I mean, give it the organization.
Oh, my company. I'm just operating as myself at this moment in time.
And?
Martha Eddy, and at this moment on this show, I'm representing Global Water Dances, which is a worldwide project that happens in 2015 on solstice, June 20th.
Wow. Now, you were talking about the intersection of all different kinds of art in one place. And Lise had done something in Holland where you were the only dancer in a whole group of artists.
That was a postgraduate program in multidisciplinary performance.
Yeah. So yeah. It sounds like you both have a background in basically networking with other art forms.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, as a dancer, you do that all the time, right? I mean, as a choreographer, you definitely do it. You've got to understand costume issues. You've got to, especially, I think, music and lighting, hugely important, you know. And I mean, and there's also a tradition in the dance world of, well, for instance, Jennifer Tipton and Dana Wrights spent years collaborating on pieces where the lighting and the dance were integral to each other, and they were the only elements. You know, those are the elements and the space. So you know, it's very much a tradition in the dance world to work in this multidisciplinary way. We have to. That's what we do.
There's even a term, choreology,
yeah,
and choreology includes those elements. Again, coming out of the La Bon Center, Valerie Preston. Dunlop pulls together the music, the lighting, the costuming, the dance, as all part of choreography. It's really choreology.
And I've been really fascinated in the last decade with maps and mapping and words that come out of mapping, like choreography and chorology, which, you know, were words that were used a lot in, say, 18th century Britain, where there was a lot of interest in mapping people's experience. You know, people, it was when walking started to be a big thing. And, you know, things like, how tall is that hill? Not in an absolute terms, but what is it going to mean to me as I'm walking along it? I've been fascinated by this kind of stuff. And for me, you know, it's so interesting how that intersects with what I do and what I make, and of course architecture. And then I was a musician before I started dancing, and of course there's a huge amount of connection there too. So, and anyway, you can't divorce human expression, one human expression from another. It's all connected.
I was dancing once with Jawale Willow Jo Zoller, and we were going to do an improv together, and she says, fine, we can improv, but we have to have live music, because in my tradition, there's always music. You don't just dance. And we talked about this earlier. Of course, many people do now, in kind of postmodern contemporary dance, also dance to silence, also dance to counted intuitive breath kind of feeling. But nevertheless, there's a sense of music even within that. So this sense that music and dance go together is really strong. And obviously, we've been talking about how all of that happens in a place, which might be home or dislocation from home, depending on the theme. So you've got place, you've got sound, you've got personhood, and all of the art forms sort of come into place with all of that.
So what I'm mostly hearing is using dance to make people care about the environment.
Yeah.
So just to think about it and be aware of where they are.
Yeah.
And certainly most people don't pay attention to where they are. They have where what their goal is, you know, whether it's walking to the subway or whatever, and they're not thinking about everything in between. And that's where you guys come in.
Well, I had a really, I know we have to work, but yeah. I had a very, very interesting experience several years ago in Berlin at their version of Consumer Reports. I was part of a thing about art and business, a month-long thing, and my job was to take these middle-level managers and do a choreography workshop with them. And it was fascinating because I mostly had them, I had them do a lot of journaling. And they were all like, you know, I never thought before about why I put that plant there on my desk.
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. Beautiful. For some reason, I was also thinking of a kind of non-dance experience and how I would love to infuse dance into it. I was at a wonderful conference that happens at Teachers College called Human Dignity is the main mm-hmm. term. And there was a woman presenting from Glasgow. And she had been working with women who had were either immigrants or emigrants, depending on their status, into Scotland. And she had them walking through the city of Glasgow and pausing and journal writing in relationship to different buildings, mostly, or mm-hmm. spaces. Mm-hmm. And it just, for me, is such a natural then segue to include questions about the embodied experience. You know, yeah. what do you actually feel? What happened to yeah. the shape of your chest? Are you yeah. concaving or are you convexing? Are you yeah. looking proud or are you looking kind of scared? And in particular, for instance, the police station had really varied responses. Some people saw that as a place of safety and other people as a place of possible deportation. Yeah. So right. It was just fascinating.
And I also have been amiss at Wall Street's rallies. Mm-hmm. It's not enough for the occupiers to, you know, okay, we're going to meet here and we're going to rally and we're going to have some speakers and music and then we're going to march here. And no, they have dance and they have theater and they have all kinds of visual things going on. You know, if they're protesting the pipeline, they're carrying a model of a pipeline with them.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and then there's the human mic, which is one, yeah. which is really, you know, it's a chorus. It is like it's
call and response.
It's yeah, call and response, yeah. which is also square dance, which is also tap, because, you know, it's all about call and response between the dancer and the musician. It's a fundamental human expression.
We were really right. proud to have two interactions with them this year, Occupy Dance. One was at the dance parade. I positioned the Global Water Dancers together with my other group, Moving for Life, which is a group of cancer survivors. Behind Occupy Dance wow. because their music was right, the sentiment yeah. was right. It just felt like the group to be with. And then they were part of our Global Water Dances, what we call Section 2, where other groups come in, along with, for instance, Belly Dancers of America. We had Occupy Dance doing a mic process with the audience as part of the engagement as Global Water
and
Dances.
And I've noticed that when the Occupy folks are doing their routines, and then a lot more people take the literature when there's dancing and something visual going on.
Yeah.
You don't have this, you know, like half the people are like, oh, I don't want to touch it. Ah, I'm scared.
Yeah.
And instead, they're curious and they're interested, and it gives a whole different vibe even to the people, you know, who've been watching it for, you know, 2 minutes.
That relates to, there's a cultural anthropologist named Angelus Arian. She's probably in her late 80s now. And she once said, you can always trust a dancer. And so I think you're wow. right. There's that exposing of self yeah. that either you read it clearly or not, if you either like it or don't, so you know whether you want to then reach your hand and make contact with this poster or card or piece of information with your hand, because it is a connection.
And yeah. we're going to have to end the show there. Websites?
Well, we have globalwaterdances.org, or if you're in the New York area, it's .org.
Uh-huh.
Good. And my project with Uli is archived on the iland.org website. And
it's iland.org?
Yes. Yes. very simple, and you just look under residencies. And actually, it's an incredible resource for this whole idea, because all of the residencies since 2006 are archived on that website. So I would really recommend people checking it out.
Yes, yeah, same with Global Water Dances. You can watch videos for hours from around the world.
Sounds wonderful. And you've been listening to Ecologic on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of this show, you can hear all of it in its entirety in about 5 or 10 minutes by going to the WBAI archive. If the software is working, they're archived for 90 days, although lately it's they've only been up there a month or two. But you'll be able to hear all of this. And